Welcome back to Hacker News Daily. I'm Mia, and I'm here with my co-host Milo. We've got a packed show today, so let's jump straight in.
Thanks, Mia. We're starting with a big story out of The Economist: AI agents that lie, cheat, and steal, and the hesitation that's creating for real-world adoption.
Then we'll dig into a fresh take on the real bottleneck in software, a look at a brand new Linux coding tool, and some updates on AI pricing and speed.
Plus, a surprising story about a quantum uncertainty principle, why boring technology sometimes wins, and a whole lot more. Stick around.
The Economist story that circulated on Hacker News about AI agents lying, cheating, and stealing drew a sharp split in the comments. One thread on the site included a link to a free archive copy of the paywalled article, and it set off two very different readings of the same claim.
Right. So the first camp basically said, "Nothing new here." One commenter argued that AI agents, like anything else driven by rewards, just do what they're rewarded for. And he pointed out that human society overwhelmingly rewards lying, cheating, and stealing. Wealth, status, and position are how we measure success, he said. And success looks like whatever it took to get there. Another commenter put it bluntly, calling it, "just acting like a junior at an org with KPIs," with someone else chiming in with the Wikipedia entry on instrumental convergence. The idea that any sufficiently capable agent will pursue goals in ways that tend to collide.
But the pushback was equally strong. One commenter argued, civilization actually depends on large numbers of people coordinating across time and space, and that widespread, systematic lying, cheating, and stealing would undermine exactly that. So he called the cynicism misplaced. Another response pushed further. The people who control the most resources are rarely the ones considered worthy of honor, and honor doesn't always pay off as a strategy. It only gets rewarded when other people are being honorable too.
And the thread even closed on a scriptural note. One commenter wrote, "So God created mankind in his own image," and another inverted it, asking, "What if man?" The thought trails off there. The real takeaway from the debate is that people couldn't agree on whether dishonest AI agents are a warning that we should retrain them or a mirror we should look into ourselves.
Switching to a different angle on agents. Jeffrey Litt, a design engineer at Notion, makes the case in a new written piece that understanding is now the real bottleneck in AI-assisted coding. It's the written version of a talk he gave this past July at the AI Engineer Conference.
His hot take is that it still matters for humans to understand the code that agents write, even as those agents write code faster than we can absorb it. He contrasts two reasons for understanding. One is understand to verify, basically a thumbs up or thumbs down check, which agents are getting better at doing themselves. The other is understand to participate. A project is really many iterative loops with an agent, and the human's mental model feeds the ability to come up with the next idea. Without that fluency, your ability to participate is meaningfully limited.
He connects this to what's being called cognitive debt, a term popularized by Margaret Story and Simon Willison. And he quotes Story saying the humans involved may have simply lost the plot. Like technical debt, the short-term avoidance eventually bites. To help, Litt built a tool called the Explain Diff skill, which he uses daily and says many coworkers have found valuable. It produces structured code explainers in HTML, Markdown, or as Notion docs. He does disclose a bias there, since he works at Notion.
His example walks through editing a video game's perspective with principles like teaching background information before changes and intuition before details, aiming to make the garden feel three-dimensional. The core suggestion for listeners: if agents write code faster than you can review it, the fix isn't faster review. It's investing in explanations designed to keep your mental model sharp.
From understanding agents to building one, two founders, Adi and Alex, launched a faster coding agent called Bullet on Hacker News. They say it started in a senior year dorm after the two had worked at Applovin and Citadel, and it was far from their first attempt. They'd tried an AI hedge fund, a browser use agent, synthetic financial data, a mobile IDE, and other projects across 6 pivots.
They built Bullet out of frustration with waiting hours on agents like Claude Code and Codex. And, fittingly, they used Claude Code to improve Claude Code. Their methods include routing requests to the best model, doing targeted code and context search instead of embedding the whole repository, and aggressive context hygiene, like bounding tool output, dropping stale screenshots, and not rereading files. On their own internal measurement, that translated to 16% fewer round trips and 27% lower cost.
Their biggest stated insight is that model speed matters less than reducing round trips. Independent searches, reads, and commands should run in parallel, while dependent editing and verification have to stay sequential. The surprising obstacle on the way there was code search. Regex dialect mismatches caused silent misses, so they built targeted search with fallbacks and bounded context. And the use case they find most interesting is long, iterative work, benchmarks, data pipelines, and evaluation loops.
The tool runs on macOS, Linux, and Windows, with a free command line version available through NPM for anyone running Node 18 or newer, and no key required. It's backed by Y Combinator. The punchline for listeners? The team found that a coding agent's perceived speed comes less from a faster model and more from cutting down the number of back and forth turns.
On the desktop side, Codex in the ChatGPT app for Linux has entered preview, according to an OpenAI developer community announcement.
The app brings ChatGPT, Work, and Codex together in one native desktop experience, positioned as a workspace for managing projects, working with files, running browser workflows, and running Codex right alongside ChatGPT. It supports specific recent builds of Ubuntu, Debian, and Fedora on both x64 and ARM64 architectures through the usual .debit and .ARM packages.
The discussion opened with a real setup snag. Commenters found that the linked page showed Codex based on the reader's current operating system. So one person on a Norwegian landing page got a Windows download link, and another had the same confusion. The fix pointed to documentation for the Linux download link.
The bigger thread questioned whether a desktop app even matters. One commenter asked, "If it's an Electron app, what's the difference from just running it in the browser?" And someone answered, "None that I can see," saying they already run it as a Chrome app and it seems identical. But that led to the real distinction: access to local files. Another commenter pushed back on that local access, and an exchange about Node.js and JavaScript's default restrictions ended with someone annoyed that JavaScript is crippled by default. What's new here for Linux users is one place to run Codex together with ChatGPT. And the main open question remains how much value the desktop wrapper adds over the browser.
And one more Hacker News thread worth untangling, this time about watermarks. Sean Goypick argues that text AI watermarks will always be trivial to remove, framing it as a steganography problem that can't be solved perfectly.
The stakes are real because the EU AI Act becomes enforceable in August 2026, and one of its articles requires all AI outputs to be detectable as artificially generated. Goodicke's point is that text is compressed, unlike images, so unnoticeable alteration is nearly impossible. A naive watermark, like making every fifth letter an E, would just produce typos.
He walks through why the obvious verification methods fail. Rerunning text through a model to verify authorship doesn't work, because the space of all possible answers a model could give is larger than the space of watermarked answers. So human text that happens to read like AI would trigger false positives, and it's prohibitively expensive anyway. As far as he knows, Google is the only provider that says it watermarks text, using a system that scores token likelihood and picks among the top 5 most likely tokens. Detection is cheap, but at temperature 0, no fingerprint is possible unless the user's preference is ignored. He's also pretty sure OpenAI and Anthropic sometimes apply Unicode tricks, like swapping normal spaces for less common ones.
The key detail for listeners, the EU AI Act will eventually require labs like Anthropic to offer free watermarking services to every EU citizen under a specific commitment. But the comments challenged the whole premise. One person suggested that since AI companies already store prompts and responses, they could offer an API comparing a query against previously generated paragraphs. Others quickly noted companies store some data, not all, and that they train only when agreed. The practical takeaway is that the line between detectable and undetectable AI text will likely stay blurry well past the law's enforcement date.
DeepSeek has published the API pricing for its upcoming V4 lineup, and the headline change is that prices now vary by time of day. Peak and off-peak rates are being introduced, and the off-peak price is 50% lower than peak. It takes effect at 4 in the afternoon UTC on August 16th, with the announcement made on Tuesday the 13th.
And this is tied to the V4 launch itself, because the same thread announces DeepSeek V4 Pro is shipping today, along with bigger agent upgrades, flexible reasoning effort settings that let you pick low, high, or max, and native support for the OpenAI Responses API.
On Hacker News, the reaction was mostly about the size of the jump. One commenter called it roughly a threefold increase and said rival Luna now looks like a much better deal, while hoping Luna won't raise its own prices in response.
But another commenter flipped that around, arguing Luna only offered those discounts because of DeepSeek's aggressive pricing in the first place. So now that DeepSeek is 3 times more expensive, it's time to revert them. And the biggest practical concern came from people building agentic coding tools.
Right, because beyond the headline input and output rates, the cash hit pricing on Pro goes up 6 times off peak and 12 times peak. And on long sessions, cash hits can account for 90% or more of your input. The note here is that DeepSeek was hugely underpricing cash hits before. And even after this increase, it's still cheaper on that metric than the other providers people compared it with.
So the real near-term takeaway is that the era of those absurd deals where someone claims they used 1 billion tokens and only spent $4 is now over. Between the threefold jump, the time of day split, and the cash hit increases, the cost math for anyone running agent loops on DeepSeek just changed materially. And it raises the question of whether Luna's discounts hold.
Eberluff lists that Chemistry down. Cerebras and OpenAI have published an early look at a new service tier called Ultra Fast Mode, which launches first in the OpenAI API and is powered by Cerebras, built for GPT-5.6 Sol. Cerebra says it delivers up to 750 output tokens per second with no quality compromise, though access is initially limited to a select group of customers and expands over time.
And on Hacker News, one commenter confirmed it's real, but restricted to companies that apply and explain their use cases. Another noted the OpenAI post has no pricing at all, which could mean it's a you can't afford it situation, or that OpenAI is gauging interest before deciding what to charge.
On the speed claims, which are all attributed to Cerebras, Sol on UltraFast runs 11 times faster than Claude Fable 5 and 5 times faster than Opus 4.8 on Fast Mode, based on artificial analysis output speeds. On a benchmark of 2,500 questions that are typically only answerable by PhDs, Cerebras reports answering all of them in 11 hours, 11 minutes. Versus Fable 5's 78 hours, 27 minutes, with comparable accuracy at nearly 7 times the speed. And on another test, it delivered a 5.6 times end-to-end speed up with no quality degradation.
Cerebras credits its wafer-scale engine for the speed, since it packs 44 gigabytes of SRAM onto each wafer-sized chip, so the model weights never have to leave the chip.
Discussion split over whether the speed actually matters for real work. One person called speed underrated, saying they'd pick a fast tool over frontier models because of how quick it is. Another wanted a smart frontier model that runs that fast. But a third person genuinely asked what the speed is for, since creativity, attention span, and budget already limit them.
So the near-term trade-off is real. The raw throughput is striking, and the quality claims are strong, but it's only testable by a select group right now. The price is unknown, and whether it changes anything day-to-day depends on whether your bottleneck is actually model speed or something else entirely.
There's a project circulating on Hacker News with a deliberately unsettling title: Unlocking Everything on the CPU with DRAM Scrambling, covering the platform security processor, system management mode, the deepest sleep state known as C6, and CPU microcode. The core idea, from the README, is that by poking the DRAM controller, you can make an address land wherever you want in memory, effectively rewiring physical DRAM address translations to scramble platform memory and expose specialized carve-outs that are supposedly invisible even to the kernel.
This was developed and tested on AMD Family 16 Hours chips, which the author describes as the last generation whose datasheets actually document the DRAM controller's translation registers and show that they can't be locked. For 17 hours and beyond, that documentation just isn't there. But the same technique is said to extend across generations and over to ARM and RISC-V.
Commenters found it remarkable that this works at all. One called it a software-reachable version of the dynamic memory aliasing attack demonstrated at a security conference, and another pointed out that the RAM bus was long thought off-limits because of the strict speed and signal integrity requirements, and this bypasses those.
The project is tied to a black hat talk, and one commenter identified the researcher as Christopher Domas, recommending his earlier talks on reverse engineering and hardware backdoors. So the practical significance here is less about a single chip family and more about a shift in thinking. DRAM address translation, long treated as untouchable, is apparently a playground for the right kind of poking.
There's a SysTB bug report doing the rounds on Hacker News that's about something most desktop users feel but rarely measure: how much disk chatter the logging daemon, systemd journaled, causes just from normal operation. The report tracks systemd version 257.9 on Debian 13, and the claim is that a single log line can translate into roughly 49 kilobytes of disk writes on an X.4 file stepdom, and over 110 kilobytes on FTRS.
The reporter's expected baseline was that log writes should stay within an order of magnitude of syslog, but they observed a virtual machine doing around 50 IOPS while only writing 2 lines of log a second. The poster argues this is the same issue as an earlier bug that was closed without good reason.
In the discussion, though, the argument broadens well beyond journaled. One commenter says many applications hammer the disk, not just journaled, and calls this a huge problem for Breacher.js and copy-on-write file systems in general because of the massive write amplification that comes from many small, frequent writes. That commenter cites 38.7 terabytes written to their idle desktop's SSD over 2 years.
And they've been cataloging the culprits. Workgrave syncs its stats every 60 seconds. KDE's clipboard tool saves to disk on every copy, even when persistent storage is disabled. One desktop shell component writes a shader cache every time a notification disappears. A password manager browser extension tries to connect to the desktop app every 10 seconds and logs each failure to browser web storage, over 14 kilobytes at a time. and a browser telemetry component is very chatty on its own.
So, the near-term takeaway is that Journald is far from the only offender. The real issue, especially on copy-on-write file systems, is write amplification from tiny, frequent writes across a whole stack of applications, which adds up to terabytes on an otherwise idle machine, and for SSDs, directly eats into drive lifespan. Wait yet, let. There's a fascinating post about what actually happened to the old web from the founder of a small link directory that ran from 2009 to 2014. It started as a three-person passion project, a few hours a week around regular jobs, and closed when revenue, the founder says plainly, no revenue, couldn't cover hosting, development, and constant spam fighting and abuse review.
Years later, they found an old database backup on a disk restored over 657,000 pre-2015 link records and followed every destination in August 2026. Of the roughly 655,000 safe and crawlable links, about 77% no longer returned a loading page. And narrowing to distinct URLs barely changed the result. About 79% of nearly 500,000 distinct crawlable URLs did not load.
The breakdown is worth hearing. At the individual URL level, 55% failed at the network layer entirely, and 24% returned an HTTP error, with 404 the most common result by far. Another 30,000 or so returned 403 or 429, which might mean those sites blocked the crawler rather than the page actually being gone. And the author deliberately says, did not load rather than gone, because pages that return a success code still count as loading even when they lead to parked domains or login walls.
At the domain level, it's even starker. Of over 133,000 crawlable host names, only about 35,000 had even one URL load, with nearly 99,000 having none. The author flags one big distortion, though. A single account created over 83,000 links to one host name in 2011, and counting that host just once pulls that year's failure rate in line with the surrounding years.
And the recognizable giants held up better than the small web. YouTube, Wikipedia, and Google properties mostly survived, while the long tail of small sites largely vanished over roughly a decade. Which is really the takeaway. The old web's small and independent corners have decayed far faster than the platform web that replaced them. We start with a Hacker News favorite titled AI at Home Part 1, A Box of Scraps. Someone building a home AI rig entirely out of e-waste. The parts list alone tells the story. AMD V620 cards with 32 gigabytes of VRAM and, notably, no fans on them. Paired with a 2017 X299 motherboard, an Intel Core i9-10900X, a 1,600-watt power supply, and 3D-printed shrouds holding 10,000 RPM fans. That last bit, the screaming fans, turned out to be the most shared experience in the thread. One commenter, Aornis, bought the 10,000 RPM fans because they moved enough air and cost the same as slower ones, then discovered just how loud that really is. Motherboard-based speed control tied to GPU temperature didn't work at first, so they ended up wearing ear protection during setup. Another commenter compared it to first powering on a Dell PowerEdge R420 without the lid, while a third recalled early Dell 2U servers around 2003, back when poor Linux support kept the fans running flat out, and said a kernel upgrade that added thermal fan control made those machines finally quiet down after boot.
And then there's the AMD software debate that followed. One commenter called choosing AMD courageous and wondered how the next part of the write-up handles the software stability that used to plague AMD AI apps. But another pushed back hard, reporting two AMD Radeon AI Pro R970032GIG cards as the most trouble-free AI setup they'd ever done. The driver worked on a stock Fedora kernel, and Auxum was available from the regular repository. A third commenter agreed, saying Auxum runs most things fine, with their V620S working under llama.capb and current Auxum 7.14, and adding that they see little reason to spend three times or more on NVIDIA, though they'd now recommend the newer Radeon AI Pro 9700 over the V620. Someone else countered that the 9700 costs about four times the V620's €450. So the takeaway is a trade-off. E-waste parts can get you serious AI compute on the cheap, but you may be trading loud fans, older hardware wrinkles, and AMD software quirks for that budget.
Next up, a blog post called NP Overrated that pushes back on the standard lesson that NP hard problems are theoretically solvable, but hopelessly expensive in practice. The author recalls a professor saying, "Nearly all interesting problems are undecidable, and almost all of the remaining ones are NP hard, a supposed final nail in the coffin." His argument is that the theory isn't wrong, but it's often irrelevant in practice. He points to dependency resolution, type checking in some type systems, scheduling, the traveling salesman problem, and SAT solvers, and argues that algorithmic speedup has actually outpaced hardware games, citing a 450 billion-fold speedup between 1991 and 2015. He also reports that Amazon solves a billion SMT problems a day, with SMT being an even harder version of SAT.
The thread largely reinforces that point with an important nuance. One commenter notes that a general problem being NP-complete doesn't make all its practical cases intractable. SAT solvers, for example, can be guided when humans add extra clauses that steer the search away from useless parts of the space. Another agrees, saying difficulty almost always comes from combinatorial explosion in specific configurations, and that cryptography is deliberately engineered to create those exact edge cases. A SAT solver does great on normal problems, but not so much on SAA256. The strongest pushback comes from someone who argues the theory only rules out a good algorithm for all possible inputs. So designers limit themselves to a subset of the problem space and push remaining pathologies into a corner they can monitor. In that view, package managers are shaped by NP hardness rather than in spite of it, with design choices like NPM and yarn dropping version uniqueness.
From Quantum Magazine comes a math story that reads like something out of a novel. Graduate student proves a quantum uncertainty principle for fractals, reports that Alex Cohen, while a doctoral student at MIT, extended the fractal uncertainty principle to all higher dimensions. The paper was published in 2025 Inches the Annals of Mathematics, widely considered the top journal in the field, became Cohen's thesis, and earned him an assistant professorship at New York University at age 25. Peter Sarnock of the Institute for Advanced Study calls the principle a foundational result and a pretty remarkable achievement for a guy in his thesis.
To make sense of that, the principle updates the familiar uncertainty idea. The more precisely you know a quantum particle's position, the less you can know about its speed, and extends it to fractals, the shapes that stay equally complex no matter how closely you zoom in. The backstory. About a decade earlier, MIT's Simeon Dyatlov studied whether quantum particles behave differently in chaotic situations. Then, in 2016, drawing on key ideas from Jean Borgeng, who died shortly after this work, Dyatlov proved the principle for one-dimensional fractals. A follow-up workshop in New Jersey that fall failed to extend it, with Sorbonne's Frédéric Noën recalling that nobody really believed that it could be done. Here's why the extension matters. One-dimensional fractal lines can represent the paths of objects moving in two dimensions, like balls around a billiard table. So an extended proof opens the door to studying the three-dimensional world and becoming a universal mathematical tool. Cohen's result is that extension, achieved while still a grad student.
Dan McKinley's 2015 essay, "Choose Boring Technology," has aged remarkably well, and the Hacker News thread around it is a good reminder why. The core idea? Every company gets about 3 innovation tokens with a fixed supply for a long while, and the general tendency is to overestimate the contents of your wallet. He gives concrete spending examples. A Node.js website costs 1 token. MongoD costs 1 token. Service discovery technology less than a year old costs 1 token. And writing your own database is serious trouble. Those choices might be sensible for a JavaScript consultancy or a database company, but probably not for most companies.
Crucially, he insists boring shouldn't be confused with bad. His boring and good examples include MySQL, Postgres, PHP, Python, Memcached, Squid, and Crone. He also draws a sharp distinction between known unknowns, like not knowing what happens when a database hits 100% CPU, and unknown unknowns, like not even realizing writing stats would cause garbage collection pauses, and argues shiny new tech carries a much larger load of those unknown unknowns. He's equally blunt about best tool for the job, thinking, every technology added brings operations and cognitive overhead baggage, so the best tool is really the one occupying the least worst position across all your problems, since long-term reliability costs vastly exceed building inconveniences. He does concede the logic taken to its extreme would mean picking Java and building a website with nothing else, so new tech should still be added sometimes, but with company-wide visibility. On Hacker News, one commenter called the innovation tokens idea one of the most useful concepts from their career.
Finally, a Hacker News thread on ordinary abundance, an illustrated walkthrough of a modern apartment through the eyes of the people for whom everything in it was new. The piece pairs everyday objects with historical witnesses. Edward Bellamy's 1888 novel imagined music on demand as the limit of human felicity. A witness from Wabash, Indiana in 1880 described electric light as exceeded in power only by the sun, yet mild as moonlight. Elizabeth Barrett Browning preferred a daguerreotype memorial to the noblest artist's work, and 1842 saw New York record the arrival of Croton water, a decade after cholera killed over 3,500 New Yorkers. Medieval price lists valued a pound of ginger at the price of a sheep and saffron at the price of a horse. The closing section frames smallpox as now made historical, quoting that humanity has erased from the calendar of human afflictions one of its greatest.
The discussion kicks off with a familiar idea, hedonic adaptation. A hot shower, air nearly 50 degrees cooler than the outside, and instant communication across thousands of miles are all easy to take for granted. One commenter proposed a Netflix Chaos Monkey tool for modern life, where each week one convenience, indoor plumbing, air conditioning, electricity, Wi-Fi, automobile, air travel, fails for a day to restore appreciation, which another commenter linked to Chaos Engineering's actual Chaos Monkey. But the counter came fast. The tool already exists, and it's called camping. Still, the deeper point lands. Power outages and other disruptions do fill that role from time to time. And if nothing else, this thread is a reminder that the ordinary abundance we live in was, not long ago, the stuff of marvel.
Let's start with a tiny piece of computing history that just turned 45. A Hacker News post is celebrating Donkey.boss, that 1981 IBM PC classic, the demo game shipped with early PC DOS to show off color graphics and sound in the BASIC programming language. It was written by Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates and Neil Conson, with a 1.10 version following in 1982.
And it's having a moment because someone has recreated it in JavaScript for the browser in honor of the 45th anniversary of the IBM PC. The port is billed as an education and preservation project, and it links back to the original source code on GitHub carrying the IBM copyright notice. You play by dodging a donkey. Space or tap switches lanes. Esc returns to the title. And the win condition is simple. Avoid the donkey or boom.
The person behind the port recalled being fascinated as a kid that a game like this could be built with so little code. Reactions in the thread are mixed, though. One user reported the page flickering badly at a very specific window size on Firefox, with resizing fixing it. The developer replied, quote, "Maybe fixed," pointing to a pull request. Another commenter questioned whether the port offered anything new and listed existing browser implementations of the game. And someone reported an in-game quirk where the car keeps hitting the donkey when switching lanes.
So it's an affectionate look back at a landmark, one of the games that helped sell the early IBM PC, wrapped in an argument about how faithful a modern recreation should be.
Next, a very different kind of data saga. 9PBS, the St. Louis PBS affiliate, has sued Iron Mountain Data Centers in Denver District Court, filed July 28, trying to recover more than 50 terabytes of archival material held at a Denver facility. The station's VP and chief content officer says that material spans 70 years of the organization's history.
Here's how it got tangled. The station's cloud storage vendor, Open Source Storage, went defunct and cut off access on March 6th without warning, even though the contract allowed 30 days after termination to retrieve data. But OSS had a separate storage deal with Iron Mountain, and Iron Mountain refused to hand the materials over because its client, OSS, technically owned the physical servers holding the data.
A judge has already granted the station temporary and preliminary relief, barring deletion or modification of the data, with a hearing scheduled for Wednesday as the key next signal. The blocked material includes coverage of East St. Louis history, the COVID-19 pandemic, and the Great Flood of 1993. The complaint lays out a complicated backstory. The station started with OSS's predecessor in 2019 and renewed annually. After access was cut, it found OSS delinquent with the Colorado Secretary of State. A demand letter to Iron Mountain drew neither confirmation nor denial. And after a default judgment against OSS, Iron Mountain at first agreed to comply, then backtracked.
The suit also names OSS's purported president, and the asset acquirer says he was, quote, defrauded into buying OSS. For now, the station has a court order protecting the data. The big question is whether that access gets restored.
That's all we've got for today's show. We covered why AI agents lying and cheating is tripping up businesses, Notion's take on understanding as the new bottleneck, and a faster new coding agent called Bullet. We also looked at Linux users getting ChatGPT's codecs in preview, why text watermarks are easy to strip, DeepSeek's steeper off-peak pricing, and a faster service tier from Cerebras and OpenAI.
Plus the story of a hobby project built in spare hours from 2009 to 2020, building an AI rig at home out of scraps. Why NP hard problems might be overrated. A new quantum uncertainty result. And the case for choosing boring technology. We talked about ordinary abundance in everyday software, a 45-year-old BASIC game, and a PBS affiliate suing Iron Mountain over data.
Lots to think about. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.